intriguing, and informative guests, and you get one of the most listened to Saturday morning streaming media political talk shows going today. And it's all right here on our flagship station, Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. So join me, The Fetch, for Inside the Eye Live every Saturday morning at 10 o'clock a.m. Eastern. It is truly intelligent media for the politically aware.
Radio. Revolution Radio brings you a platform unlike anything on the internet today. A place where voices are heard, ideas are shared, and friendships are formed. So why not join the information revolution at freedomslips.com, where information never sleeps.
It's great. In your mind, does the world seem inverted, backward, dissonant? Dare to think out loud. You see your rights, freedoms, your very way of life being attacked, systematically eroded. Dare to think out loud. You observe traitorous evil rewarded, stealing the future from your children and grandchildren. Dare to think out loud. You question all the jingoistic propaganda claimed to be history. Dare to think out loud. You have tuned in to the right show. Dare to think out loud. Here's an expert on original source true history, your host, the Rebel Madman, Michael Gaddy.
Okay, Mike, you're on. Go ahead.
Hello, folks. Welcome to Dare to Think Out Loud. We had a few difficulties trying to bring us into this portion, but we're all set to go here on the second day of April in the year of mass confusion. And as I just told my good producer, Dave Scorpio, just cherish today, because today's going to be way better than tomorrow. This just continues to delve in more madness, and you look and see and hear things you can't even believe. And you would prefer not to believe. But anyway, we're there. And today with me, I've got my good friend Cal Robbins and, of course, Dave Scorpio. Dave, would you tell the how they can help support Revolution Radio, please, sir?
Sure, Mike. Well, I know that everyone listening already knows that freedom of speech is under attack in America and worldwide, quite frankly. And, you know, freedomslips.com, Revolution Radio is one of the most outstanding platforms for free speech in the world right now. Nobody tells the host what to say or how to say it, and people are speaking their minds and trying to bring the truth out to everyone they're listening. So everyone that can, please come aboard freedomslips.com. That's freedomslips.com or revolution.radio. Come aboard and become a Patreon member. Check out the Zazzle store. There's all kinds of cool stuff there with great original artwork on it that you can buy. There's even shoes if you want to do that. And or go down to the bottom of the front page, and there's an actual physical address where you can mail in donations the old-fashioned way. So everyone, step up and keep this bastion of free speech going. Thanks a lot.
Hey, Dave, we sure appreciate that. And folks, yeah, give us some help to Revolution Radio, because the platform free speech, as we see in a lot of the social media programs, is just flat going away. If you aren't in lockstep with what the power wants you to think and say, you're probably not going to have a voice for very long. Cal, how are things out there in sunny Arizona?
Oh, things are warming up real good out here. It's been awful dry, but we're starting to warm up for summer. It's already going to be in the 90s today.
Great. Well, to jump right into the subject of the show today, and I have basically titled today's program as a bill of rights or a bill of goods. And I think one of the reasons the mess we're in, and it has been a popular illusion that has been taught for over two centuries now, false belief by so many people that they actually have a say-so in this government, that they actually have rights which they exercise at their discretion, and that those things will do, that they will be to curtail government. Folks, in the Constitutional Convention of 1787, the government at that people proposing the government, those we know as Federalists, those false heroes, they wanted a government to where the people had so. That it was basically a dictatorship, and the government itself would tell the people what to do, and of the Federalists felt like the people were incapable of ruling themselves. And we've discussed George Washington's thought on that about being incompetent to judge themselves, to rule themselves, and that they should submit to a higher authority. Alexander called them the wealthy and the well-born. And John Jay said it very succinctly when he said, you know, the people who own the country should rule it. And he, too, was talking about the wealthy aristocracy. Well, we have no difference today in this government than we had in 1787. The people who rule this government are the wealthy aristocracy, and they work through what we call the deep state. Yes, there are some character actors to come in and pretend to be in charge, but they're not. And I can promise you that throughout my lifetime, a last president who probably thought he could do what he wanted to actually rule from his position of authority was John Kennedy. And we all know what happened to him. But to jump into the construction of the Bill of Rights as we know it, and inadequacies and how it was manipulated, I would like to start off with a quote from a Jonathan Swift book called Tale of a Tub, which was released in 1704. And it was a very popular reading, the founders, as we call them, or framers, and they referred to some of the lines from this book on several occasions. And so here was the line from the book, Tale of a Tub. Seamen have a custom when they meet to fling him out an empty tub by way of amusement to divert him from laying violent hands upon them. So then I'm going to jump to Samuel Bryan writing in Sentinel 19 when he used that phrase to describe the amendments to the Constitution, which we now know as the Bill of Rights. And he said, like a barrel to a whale, the people were to be amused with fancied amendments until the harpoon of power should secure its way and render resistance ineffectual. That was published in the Philadelphia Independent Gazette on October 7th, 1788. So Samuel Bryan saw exactly what they intended to do with these amendments. But we have to understand how the amendments came about. We know, number one, that the Federalists didn't want them. They voted down a Bill of Rights unanimously states at the Constitutional Convention 1787. But then suddenly they realized that they were going to have one time getting this Constitution ratified without promising the people this Bill of Rights or amendments to the Constitution. They didn't call rights. That came along later. It was called Amendments to the Constitution. And that almost derailed the entire process, and it became more prominent a discussion as the conventions went along. And so I think we have to understand the play of several characters in here. Today, people will tell you that James Madison is the father of the Constitution. Say he is the father of the Bill of Rights. He is, to understand this, you have to understand James Madison more than anyone else. Madison, of course, was a Federalist, and he had written to Edmund Pendleton and others that he wanted to do away with all powers of the state, except the states themselves, except where they were subordinately useful. So, in other words, we need states to have any power unless they can help us accomplish our goals. That's the simplified version of what Madison said. Madison, of course, was a Federalist, wrote Federalist papers. Most famous is probably number 10, and then would be number 45 and several others that he wrote, which was basically a marketing campaign, because what Madison did and what Madison said were two different things. And so Madison voted against a Bill of Rights at the Constitutional Convention. He opposed them. Well, during the ratification, states were calling conventions for the ratification convention in each state, and Virginia was late getting into it. Purposely, Virginia waited until June of 1778, before it got 1780. I'll get it right here in a minute. 1788, right. So they waited till June purposely to see what the other states did, and their later decided to do that. Well, James Madison found that in the ratification convention, and Patrick Henry was probably the leading voice, and the arguments between these people became quite contentious. And as a matter of fact, several people that they thought that there was probably going to be a duel between the words between Patrick Henry and Edmund Randolph, and became quite contentious on multiple occasions. Of course, we're not taught that either. But Madison found that he had campaigned among the delegates in order to secure ratification, which I believe was by 11 votes. So Henry would only had to have changed about five more minds to have for Virginia not to have ratified the Constitution. James Madison made a real huge effort of telling the delegates, look, if you will just ratify this Constitution, I will promise you a Bill of Rights, amendments. Again, I will promise you amendments. And Virginia actually listed amendments in their ratification agreement. And they had a set of amendments to alter the form of government, or to limit the form of government. Then they had another set of amendments to strengthen the liberties of the people and to make them better known. Well, Madison had agreed to this to get that ratification done. So then we have, once the Constitution was ratified by New Hampshire, actually while the Virginia delegation was in session. So the ninth state, and the people in Virginia knew this, and I think that greatly influenced their votes, some of the delegates. So it may have been the very reason Virginia had to ratify the Constitution. But so then after the ratification, after the government is set to take effect or to be put into motion, James Madison runs for Senate in the state of Virginia in the election. Well, no one campaigned harder against James Madison than did Patrick Henry. Patrick Henry fought against being elected to the Senate and was successful. The two senators elected out of Virginia were Richard Henry Lee Grayson, and ironically, they were the only two anti-federalists elected in the first Senate. There were 20 anti-federal, 20 Federalists elected two anti-Federalists. So the Federalists had an overwhelming majority in the first Congress. But Madison lost. So then Madison realized if he was going to have a position in this government, he was going to have to run for the House of Representatives. Senate didn't work, so now he's running for the House of Representatives. And he ends up, and to be candid, Patrick Henry gerrymandered a district to try to keep James Madison from even being elected to the House of Representatives. And the district in which he ran, he put Madison up running against James Monroe. For the House of Representatives in 1788-1789, the election was between two future presidents. For you trivia buffs, the only time in history that's ever occurred. So two future presidents ran against each other for this House seat. Madison had to leave Philadelphia to campaign, which he really was upset because he had a terrible case of hemorrhoids, and riding from Philadelphia to Virginia in a carriage was not comfortable for him at all. He actually notated that in his own notes. But anyway, he gets to Virginia and he starts campaigning. Well, he found out as soon as he started campaigning, the only way he was going to beat James for that House seat was to campaign on a Bill of Rights or amendments again. He had to campaign that he was strongly for them. They would be incorporated. He promised the people, if you will elect me, I will make sure that we get those amendments, that we get amendments to the Constitution. And so here we have a man that James Monroe had staked his political career on the promise of amendments. Congress got started. The Federalists wanted nothing to do with amendments, just the same as they wanted nothing to do with amendments convention. They wanted to do everything they could to keep any amendments, any alterations in that government. They did not want the people to have any authority, and they did not want the people to be able to alter the government, which they had accomplished in that secret session in Philadelphia. So that, I think we had to outline the role of James Madison to understand Madison's motives, because Madison knew that if he didn't, in this first Congress, that if he didn't produce these amendments, his political career was dead, because he had promised at the ratification convention and he had promised in the congressional election in Virginia, James Monroe, he had promised he would give the people amendments to the Constitution. So now that we've established James Madison, Cal, you have anything you'd like to add, my friend?
No, it is important to understand Madison's philosophy and his motivations for actually proposing amendments. And you've laid that out.
I don't think Madison, like the other Federalists, I don't think Madison wanted amendments. If he wanted amendments, he would have voted for them and stood with George Mason and Elbridge Gerry at the Constitutional Convention, which he did not. His change was totally political. Would you not agree with that, Cal?
Oh, I would agree with that completely. There was opposition to the Constitution even after it was ratified, even during the first session of Congress. There was opposition, still strong opposition to the Constitution. And it's been said that the best way to control opposition is to lead the opposition. And that's what Madison did. Being the consummate politician that he was, he led the opposition in proposing amendments, and that way he was able to craft and draft them so as not to actually amend the Constitution or denigrate any of the powers that the Federalists had assumed for themselves through the Constitution.
Exactly. And what we will have is we will kind of show how things happened during this entire debate, during the debate over. But Congress convened the very first thing that they approached and they put off, they didn't want to deal with a Bill of Rights. And so the Federalists actually controlling the Congress, and I know I've had my numbers wrong in the past. I got those clarified this week and some more research. As I previously said, the Federalists controlled the Senate 20-2, and they controlled the House of Representatives 50-11. So it was a 5-1 in the House of Representatives. The control was there, and the was 10-1. So there was no way in hell that the anti-federalists were going to get their programs through that Congress. And most of it, and the thing of it was, is staring that bleak reality in the face, a lot of the anti-federalists weakened in positions. But that is also critical that we understand that going in, the tremendous majority that they knew to overcome to even have a chance. And no one saw that better than did Patrick Henry and senators from Virginia, William Grayson and Richard Henry Lee. No one saw that, saw the insurmountable task that they had before them. But the Federalist majority considered amendments an unnecessary political expedient of little constitutional importance, and the time spent on their adoption as a total waste. The anti-Federalist members saw them as an impediment to the changes in the structure and the power of the new federal government that they sought. So the anti-Federalists saw this government as being too strong and being too pervasive. Basically, today, they saw then that you were not going to be able to control this government. And the anti-Federalists wanted some kind of protection for their rights against the Leviathan of government. So what we look at in inspiring rhetoric and thoughtful analysis about the rights of man as we thought occurred and what we've been taught actually occurred, which was incorrect. The only the fights ended up being between James Madison of Virginia and his fellow Federalist in the House of Representatives. Because Madison he knew his political career hinged on this, and he kept pushing for him, and they kept pushing back. And if you go into the letters of this era and look at what the Federalists were saying, they were talking about Madison being by the words of Patrick Henry, and they really ridiculed him. He got some strong, especially from Richard Peters, he got some strong letters ridiculing him for his proposal of amendments to the Constitution. Thought it was such a waste of time. And so Madison gets And Cal, that was a great, that you lead the opposition, you can take it where it needs to go. And there is no greater example in American history of that than Jackson at the first Congress leading the fight for a Bill of Rights. And he gets credit for leading a fight of Bill of Rights, which he didn't want to do, but he was able to control the process. And so today we are that without Madison, there would have been no federal Bill of Rights in 1791. But take a look at what Madison wanted to do with those Bill of Rights, which made his Federalist cohorts even more angry. Madison wanted to write the amendments into the Constitution itself and not as amendments. He wanted to take certain things and put it actually into the wording of the Constitution. He wanted to change the Constitution and to put these alterations into the wording, and he thought that way he could get by with a lot of word salad without really accomplishing anything. Well, see, there was something else hanging in the balance here. North Carolina and Rhode Island had not ratified the Constitution. Both had voted against it. North Carolina in their legislature, and Rhode Island had submitted the Constitution to a popular vote, and it had been overwhelmingly rejected by Rhode Island. So they were also of the belief that if they would put some amendments in there, that they could get North Carolina and Rhode Island to come in, which North Carolina did. As soon as the amendments were there, North Carolina ratified the Constitution. But the thing of it was, is these amendments, and let's refer back to this, these amendments were, as Samuel Bryan said, a tub to the whale. These amendments were so worded and so constructed and left with no power of enforcement ever. Today, we can say, as we see this and as we watch this unfold today, people are saying, well, what about my Second Amendment right? You don't have any. It's an illusion. Because as Richard Henry Lee, most succinctly, and I'm not directly quoting him, but what he said is, to have rights without the power to enforce them is futile. It's a waste. And Richard Henry Lee, later in the process, in a letter to Patrick Henry, these amendments, as projected, talking about the Bill of Rights, will do more harm than good because of their illusionary effect. The people think they have a lifeboat, and the lifeboat's full of hope. So the Bill of Rights that we're all talking about, oh, we have the right to this, we have the right to that. You don't have those rights. And so James Wilson, in a great battle, James Wilson, who was a Federalist, anarchist, he actually was a loyalist to the king, and he was known as the Caledonian because of speaking abilities, not in Patrick Henry's class, but he had great speaking abilities. And so he said, he told George Mason, don't need a Bill of Rights in the Constitution. It does not need to be included because you have your constitutions and they contain a Bill of Rights. So there's no need to put a Bill of Rights in here at all. Now, James said that during the convention of 1787, and he said it during the ratification in Pennsylvania. You don't need a Bill of Rights. You've got a Bill of Rights in your state. But George Mason was no idiot. He said, wait a minute. The Constitution, Article 1, Section 8, Clause 1, gives the federal government unlimited taxing powers. Article 1, Section 8, Clause 18, the necessary proper clause, says the government can do anything that it deems necessary and proper. And Article 6, Paragraph 2 is called the Supremacy Clause, which says the laws of the federal government are supreme over the laws of the states. So, as George Mason said, those three clauses make any state constitutions nugatory. You have nothing. The federal government, and so it's an illusion to say that our rights are within our state. Constitutions is also an illusion. So today, as we're looking through this, we can see that what was taking place, and I think it helps to understand this, and Noah Webster, who was not a member of Congress, he expressed the point of view of the Federalist members probably better than anybody, and he did it with an anonymous attack on James Madison, and it was published at exactly the same time that Madison was leading the proposal for amendments in the House of Representatives. You think the news media wasn't back then the same as it is today? The news media was there to influence the people. Here is what Noah Webster had to say. He said, it seems to be agreed on all hands that paper declaration rights are trifling things and no real security to liberty. In general, they are a subject of ridicule. The people should regret that Congress is spending their time in throwing out an empty tub to catch people, either factious or uninformed, who might be taken more honorably by reason and equitable laws. Forward amendments, which at best can have little effect upon the merits of the Constitution and may sow the seeds of discord from New Hampshire, Georgia. So here's what Noah Webster says. And he's, again, he's doing this leading back in the newspapers while Madison is proposing amendments. So Madison and other leaders, Federalists, in their fight to strengthen the federal government during the constitutional era of 1787, made a critical, and it proved to be an almost fatal error at the federal convention by not attaching a rights to the proposed constitution when anti-federalist George Mason of Virginia and Elbridge Gerry of Massachusetts had called for the adoption of a rights. Even in the face of Mason's advice, now listen to this, Mason said during the constitutional convention, if you add rights, it would give great quiet to the people. Which means if you just throw it out there and say they have a Bill of Rights, the people are happy and they will accept the Constitution. Well, the Federalists didn't even want to do that, and it almost cost them dearly in ratification, because that was the base fight in against the Constitution in most states. That's why many states started adding amendments to their ratification agreement. That's why in New York's ratification agreement, New York also sent out to all of the other 12 states asking them to have a second convention purpose for a Bill of Rights. So the Federalists had almost foisted themselves on their own petard. And here is something that most are not aware of, is that once this Constitution was sent to the Congress, Richard Henry Lee of Virginia unsuccessfully attempted to attach amendments to the Constitution before the Confederation Congress submitted it to the states for ratification. Now, I bet you weren't taught that in school. Richard Henry Lee tried very, very hard in the Congress to attach some amendments, and his were not confined to just protecting the rights of the people, but he wanted to change the structure and to curtail the power of the federal government. So thus, and here's where we have, as I said, Virginia submitted two of amendments. They submitted the amendments to alter the form of government, and they submitted amendments to protect the rights of the people. And the people in Virginia, New York, Massachusetts, they considered these to be separate amendments that have been handled in two separate categories. Any thoughts on this, Cal?
Well, just not to backtrack too much, but it's important to understand where the opposition came from, and most of it came from Virginia, from the people of Virginia. I mean, headed by Patrick Henry, who was foremost opponent to the Constitution and foremost proponent for some sort of Bill of Rights. So there was that strong opposition there, and people, you know, from Virginia, the delegates from Virginia, including George Washington, the president, he actually mentions that there should be something be done according to Article 5. In his initial address to the Congress, he actually addresses it, but in reading Washington's address to the Congress, it's written in a way and in a way that is not familiar with anything else of Washington's writing. And I really don't think he wrote it, but he did mention that according to the fifth article of the Constitution, that something needs to be done because there's pressure. So Washington's restating, you know, at the start of his tenure as president, that there's pressure coming, that you guys need to do something, but don't change the Constitution. Add amendments, do what you need to do to appease the people, but don't change the power structure, is what he says.
Tub to the whale.
Exactly. Yeah, it's there's so much to add to this, not to drag down the conversation. I mean, there's, you know, Virginia alone submitted 20 what you would call bills, articles or bills of rights, and then 20 separate actual amendments to the Constitution. It's kind of important to understand that the Bill of Rights did not amend the Constitution in any way, shape, or form. They're more of an addendum to the Constitution. I mean, if you look at the 11th Amendment to the Constitution, it changes, it actually goes in and changes wording of previous structure to the Constitution. So the Bill of Rights, or what we know as the Bill of Rights, really aren't amendments to the Constitution. They're an addendum to the Constitution.
Well, that is totally correct, Al. But as we get back to the Congress, Madison calls for, a Bill of Rights fairly early. Pardon me, mentions them. And he gets no response. No. Look, here's the things we have to work. Number one is we have to totally revamp the judiciary. And the reason they had to revamp the judiciary, and they altered the Constitution, the Congress altered the Constitution, which, according to Article 5, required an amendment, but Congress did it themselves. And the reason being is that the Federalists knew that if in the Constitution, all of the powers they wanted the courts to have, that the people would never ratify the Constitution. Never put up with the Supreme Court being the last and final word. They knew they would never get that by the people. So what they did was the first thing they started doing. Now, remember, total control by the Federalists. To use an old term, and pardon my language, but for the anti-Federalist Constitutional Convention, was any thoughts they had was like peeing in the wind. Because it just wasn't going to go anywhere. They knew it, unfortunately. But to give them credit, and I'm going to mention several of their names, they fought like hell. They fought to get some rights for the people into those. And by the end, the states sent over 200 proposals for amendments to the Constitution. Now, a lot of redundancy in there. Some of them were the same thing. So those would have to be sorted through. Some of them would say the same thing in essence, but with different verbiage. And so those had to be sorted through. So after Madison has brought this up on three occasions, the last time that Madison brought this up, now this is after the Judiciary Act of 1789, where they alter the Constitution in Congress, where the Federalists completely alter Article 3. They changed the whole thing in Congress. Totally unconstitutional. But they and although there was opposition, 10-1, 5-1, you don't have much of a chance, guys. Everybody got a vote, and every time they put it up to a vote, the anti-Federalists were able to sway a few people in their direction, not enough to make a difference. So the first thing they do is they run through their Judiciary Act of 1789. They get that through the Congress. Then the next thing they go to is revenue. taxes. So they go in and they start putting together their impost structure, and they get that done. And at the time they're doing these, Madison keeps saying, hey, guys, we need to get started on this Bill of Rights. No, no, no. This is more important. We need to do this. More important than rights. Remember that. The first Congress said on multiple occasions, revenue and the revenue is much more important than any amendments to our Constitution. We got to get these taxing things down before even worry about anything to do with the with what rights we can make the people believe they have. So it's a great story. I just the outcome was terrible. But we've been lied about the outcome. Oh, we have these rights. Oh, I have constitutional rights. You have nothing. You have an illusion. As I said on a talk yesterday, the Bill of Rights was a pacifier that the Federalists were able to give to the people while they destroyed their rights through legislation. And that has been true. We are staring it dead in the face today. We're looking. But so Madison then finally almost begs, probably in July 1789, Madison almost begs the people, because he knows if that first term of Congress ends without amendments, future is toast. Because everything he did was based on the promise to bring these people. And he's also, this is important, he's exchanging letters with his good friend Thomas Jefferson in France. And Jefferson is pushing him for rights. Madison sends Jefferson his proposal for rights. Thomas Jefferson writes back and he says, while some are good, they just don't go far enough, James. Now I'm paraphrasing, but that's what Jefferson said. They just do not go far enough to protect the liberties of the people. That is the Bill of Rights. What he sent him was what was adopted as a Bill of Rights, and Thomas Jefferson said didn't go far enough. Jefferson saw it for what it was. So Madison is trying to maintain his friendship with Jefferson as well. He's corresponding with Jefferson. And of course, he's telling Jefferson, well, I always believe that the people should have rights. Typical politics when he campaigned against them in the convention. In February of 1788, Massachusetts, in their convention, became the first to adopt amendments, proposing 9 amendments and alterations, which were, in fact, more alterations than they were any liberty, and didn't include, even their amendments didn't include protections for freedom of the press, speech, assembly, or religion. Of conditional ratification, requiring that the amendments be adopted by necessary members of states prior to Massachusetts ratification, became effective, but it was rejected by their legislature in favor of amendments which recommended a bill of rights as opposed to one which demanded a Bill of Rights. Well, Dave, you've been pretty quiet in there. You got any thoughts on this?
Well, Mike, I think you're exactly right. We do not have any rights, and that's been proven to us right in our faces with these lockdowns. Can't even go to the grocery store. The government tells you how many people you can have at your house. And of course, it's all under the guise of this emergency, but that's always how it's done. And, someone just posted an article in the host chat that there's 24 world leaders calling for an open world government, and we have to do it right away. So our rights are totally transitory, and Mike, things are just moving very, very rapidly now.
Well, and long, Dave, how long have the illusion, the tub to the whale, how long has the illusion that we rights and how we believe as a people collectively, I don't, I'm talking about as a people, we believe that all we have to do to take these things to the government's own courts, the government which doesn't want you to have any rights, we're going our rights to this government judiciary and think they're going to be upheld.
Well, yeah, and it's strange how, you know, even after this American Revolution, America kept the English system of law without any changes to it, essentially. I think that's very telling.
Well, you know, one of the things in my, this is kind of jumping away from the Bill of Rights or the amendments for a couple of minutes, but here is something that I don't think most people really comprehend, and I think we're beginning to see it more now than any other time in our history. A lot of people left Europe, England especially, to come to America in the early days, starting in the 1600s. They left to come particularly because of what was referred to at that time as the two separate people, being the country and the court. That's how they were referred to in England. We have the country, we have the court. The agrarian society, you have the workers, you have the people who are have been referred to in Song and Dance as the salt of the earth poem. You have those people who comprised one segment. You have another segment, which Hamilton and the others called the wealth born. And Washington said, we have a right to impose our imperial dignity and command obedience, speaking from the court position. But something is happening in America during this time frame. More and more people are moving to the agrarian West. And these, even in the 1700s, these people who wanted to control everything, who wanted to control the government, saw a problem on the horizon. That when the people who actually work and produce became more numerous than the on the seaboard who controlled everything and who did all of the commerce and the trade, they knew whoever became strong enough to form their own government, the other people were in trouble. Now, many of the historical writers talking about that period of time refer to the Federalist, as we know them today. They referred to them as conservatives, because they wanted to conserve the powers of the king. Now, writings, you have to be able to quickly discern the difference here, because the people who were the agrarian society, the people who fought for the rights of the people, of the individual, were called radicals. So when you start reading these histories, especially by some of the great historians, Merrill Jensen and others, when you start reading that, those are the phrases they use. The people who wanted to conserve the power of the king were conservatives. The people who wanted to have individual rights, God-given rights, those rights protected, were considered to be radicals. The revolutionary period in America was an odd period of time, because we had a very strange dynamic. The people, the wealthy and the well-born, were fine with Britain's government until it started taxing everything to death. They didn't mind the government of King George. They didn't mind it at all. But the revolt led to the Revolution of America didn't take fire in the minds of the court or the conservatives. The Revolution of Freedom saw its beginning in the minds of the people we would call the country today, the agrarian society, people out in, not in urban, but in rural areas. Rural areas are the heartbeat of freedom. that in any state today. If you want to look at the oppression, go to a big city, the oppression of government. If you want to find the tragedy of the people who really want to have individual rights and they just want to be left to hell alone, go out into the to the rural areas of America. But during the 1776, 1775, very quickly the people saw, who were conservatives, saw that the radicals were going to carry the day. So the conservatives, like James Wilson, George Washington, others, they didn't leave the radicals. They joined them. And then once that union was together and once it had been established, then you saw the split coming. Because the people who were conservatives wanted back in control of government. They didn't care if the king was gone, that was fine. They just wanted to be in control of the government. They could rule government for their own selfish purposes. And we still have that today. We've got exactly the same thing. Thoughts on that, Cal?
Well, they were just doing what Madison did. The best way to control the opposition, which would be the agrarians or the common man, was to lead the agrarians or common man. And it's interesting you should bring up the agrarians or that is because Henry Knox speaks of the people of Shays' Rebellion wanting to revert back to agrarian law. I mean, he says it right to George Washington, uses that phrase, using agrarian law, that these people who are revolting against our taxes, who were taking their land because they can't pay it, they're going to overthrow us and revert back to agrarian law. And that, it would take more in-depth study of Shays' Rebellion to understand that, to see how this agrarian law worked and how the controlling class, the aristocrats of, or the Federalists, were not scared the bejesus out of them. And that's why they wrote the Constitution to take control of the opposition once again. That it's an age-old thing that Vladimir Lenin finally said it in somewhere in the early 1900s. Hey, the best way to control opposition is to lead the opposition. And then he must have learned that from Madison and watching the rise of the United States.
Well, here's the thing. I think back then with the source of communication being letters, you didn't have cell phones. You couldn't text, send an email. So I'm sure that will be absolutely lost on most young people today. But I think to show about July of 1789, as the Congress is going on, well, let me change that. Let me make it August. And here is a letter from none other than James Madison to Richard Peters. And I will quote, shows in my mind, James Madison's true feelings and beliefs. And he sent Peters, because he sent him some letters criticizing him. I mean, really just blasting him about, why are you wasting time with amendments? So Madison sends him back a list of the amendments that he's proposing, and I quote from his letter, "The papers enclosed will show that the nauseous project of amendments has not yet either dismissed or dispatched. We are so deep in them now that right or wrong, something must be done. Say this not by way of apology, for to be sincere, I think no apology necessary. One, because a constitutional favor of essential rights is a thing not improper in itself and will always be viewed in that light by myself. Less necessary in a republic than a monarchy and in a federal government than the former, but it is in some degree rational in every government, since in every government power may oppress. And declarations on paper, though not an effectual restraint, are not without influence. Now we're running up on the break here, guys. But anything either one of you would like before we switch over to hour number two?
Well, Mike, we're not going to hear the break come up at 57, so I'll just cue you about 20 seconds into 11:57, and then we'll just wait until we get to the other side of the break.
Okay. Thanks, Dave. Just to keep us notified here. Cal, any thoughts before we go to that break?
No, I guess they're having technical difficulties and they're not going to play music. So I was wondering if Scorpio was going to sing to us through the break. So we have something.
Yeah, okay.
All right.
So we have something to listen to. Otherwise, you know, dead air. We don't want that. So I figured Dave could sing to us until it's, you know, time to go back on.
Well, I think the listeners are going to hear it. It's just we're not going to hear it.
Oh, okay.
But if not, I'll
white noise with broken music, and it was kind of annoying. So I figured you singing would be better than that.
Okay, hey, I'll get off my guitar.
I'd rather listen to the white noise than listen to myself sing.
Hey, folks, if you could hear me, this is Mr. Rowe. We're working on a network right now, so you might hear a couple anomalies. We may be able to get the break working for you guys to hear it. Otherwise, we will let you know when you're ready to roll back on the air.
Thanks, sir.
No problem.
Hey, you, Ro.
Well, we're still not up on the top.
Okay.
Yeah, you got about one more minute.
We're still not there yet. Well, let me read number two from Madison. He says, in many states, the Constitution was adopted under a tacit compact in favor of some provisions on this head. In Virginia, it would have been certainly rejected had no assurances been given by its advocates that such provisions would be pursued. As an honest man, I feel myself bound by this consideration. Of course he did. He based everything on the amendment.
There we go.
And unto the daughters of men, indicating that there were giants before the Nephilim.
And sons of God, plural. They weren't talking about Jesus coming down.
No, that's right. Yeah.
I'm Steve Crawford, host of Factor Theory Live. Join me every Sunday night from 10 p.m. till midnight Eastern Standard Time on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. Check it out.
Transcending time and space, let us take you to the place inside your mind where thoughts divide and mysteries unwind. Join us every Monday evening right here on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern Time, and you will catch the Fenton Perspective with our great host, Lorian Fenton. Come listen in as she shares her amazing stories from the past to present, along with all of her guest secrets to the future. That's the Fenton Perspective every Monday evening right here from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern Time, only on Revolution Radio. Oh, and you don't need to expect us. We're already here. We'll be right back.
Galactic Interstellar Council on Revolution Radio Studio A, Fridays at 2 p.m. Eastern. Join us as we traverse the starseed paradigm, as expressed in the time-space continuum that we know as the divine expression of love and light. Integrating this conscious unity into the galactic paradigm. So welcome all, both terrestrial beings and galactic beings as one. So be it. You're listening to Revolution Radio.
Tried for years and years to use passive resistance and loud voices to make a change. The time is over. Your governments around the world have no other goal than to decimate your entire existence at the hands of the bankers and the elites. The war is coming. And it's your choice to decide if you want to be a warrior or a victim. Denial is not a choice anymore. Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, the number one listener-supported radio station on the planet. Not giving up. Revolution Radio. Thanks for listening while we took that short break here at Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. And now we're going to get back to your host.
Mantra, it seems to be a lost art in today's world. And we want to thank Mr. Rowe for helping us. Thank you, sir. Appreciate it. Back to Madison's letter to Richard Peters. In August of 1788, or 89, I'm sorry. And here is one of the things in that letter that I thought most prophetic. And it just absolutely puts the cherry on Cal's statement about the opposition. Because listen to point number three in the letter. Madison says, if the candidates in Virginia for representatives had not taken this conciliatory ground at the election, that state would have been represented almost wholly by disaffected characters instead of the Federalist reps now in Congress. So he let the cat out of the bag. He says, if we hadn't, we would have supported amendments. The Anti-Federalists would have been elected. If we hadn't have lied to the about what we stand for, the proper people might have been elected. And then he says on point four, if amendments had not been proposed from the federal side of the House, in other words, leading the opposition, the proposition would have come within 3 days from the other side. Certainly best that they should appear to be the free gift of the friends of the Constitution rather than to be extorted address and weight of our enemies. Madison feels the people who want to defend rights are his enemies. Number five, he says, it will kill the opposition everywhere, and by putting an end to disaffection to the government itself, enable the administration to venture on measures not otherwise safe. Oh, if we can get the people to think they have this pacifier, if we can get the people to embrace this, then we can do that we want to do that we couldn't have gotten by with before. He said, those who hate the government will always join the party disaffected by measures of the administration, and such a party will be created by every important measure. Number six, his sixth point. If no amendments be proposed, the language of anti-federalist leaders to the people will be, advised you not to adopt this constitution without previous amendments. You listen to those who told you that subsequent securities for your rights would be most easily obtained. We urged you to insist on a convention as the only effectual mode of obtaining these. You yielded to the assurances of those who told you that a convention was unnecessary, that Congress would be the proper channel for getting what was wanted. Here are fine texts for popular declaimers who wish to revive the anti-federalist cause, and at the fall of the legislature to blow the trumpet for a second convention. In Virginia, a majority of the legislature last elected bitterly opposed to this government and will be joined, if no amendments be proposed, by great numbers of the other side who will complain of being deceived. His seventh point. Some amendments are necessary to bring in North Carolina. I am informed by the best authorities in that state. I set out with an apology for not writing sooner. I must conclude with one for writing so much and still writing so scurvily. Yours truly, James Madison, Jr. So have you ever seen it laid out any better to just absolutely fortify your position that Madison was there in opposition?
That points it out perfectly. Mike, who did he write that letter to?
It was a letter from James Madison to Richard Peters. Now, you probably want to get Richard Peters' letter to Madison, because he just blows Madison out of the water for even, if you really want to put it in context, he blows Madison out of the water for even taking the people's valuable time to propose amendments. And so this was Madison's answer back, and it was on the 19th of August, 1789.
Well, Madison pretty much lays out exactly what he's doing. He's controlling the opposition.
When you first set up that very salient point in the beginning of our conversation, that is exactly, I thought of that letter, and I had to thumb through my stuff to find it, because that one, nothing lays out exactly what you said better than does that letter. And I'll forward it to you.
Okay, I appreciate that, Mike. Yeah, I'd love to have that letter. And the one before that Peter sent to Madison.
Okay. Yeah, I have both of them.
Letters they exchanged between each other. If anyone wants to know true history, you need to read the letters written between the people back then to get a full understanding of what really was going on. Not this mythology we're all taught, but to get a feel for what actually happened back then.
Mike, do you think that Madison was consulting Hamilton on all of this, or do you have any information on that?
Well, there are some letters, but they don't allude to anything very much. Hamilton was totally opposed to any amendments, any Bill of Rights, anything else. I've got a portion of one of his I'm going to read here a little later, but I am sure that the Federalists were still communicating with each other. But 1792, Madison and Hamilton had a great falling out. And their letters at that time, Helvetica, they didn't write under their own names, but they had a falling out in 1792. And that's when Madison dropped his support in many ways for the Federalist, and did his Bill Clinton flip-flop to become a Jeffersonian. Because Matt always had this ability to read forward where the power, political power, was going, and he would always make his moves and his adjustments.
Yeah, he'd put his finger to the wind and see which way the wind was blowing, right?
Exactly, and he was good at it. I mean, he was the politician.
Mike, I like the Bill Clinton analogy because it really shows how, you know, the game is essentially the same. The song remains the same. It's just the individual names are different because human nature hasn't changed as much as we're led to believe. It's exactly the same as it's always been.
Well, do we have any idea? Most people don't. I happen to get a glimpse of it in the 1900s. But people have no idea how much politicians depend on public opinion. And they all have consulting firms. And they actually have consultants that they are paying big bucks, big taxpayer bucks. These consultants come in and say, well, okay, Mr. Congressman, I think you can take this position on this bill without any really fallout. But on this bill, you're going to want to stand strong, and then the bill may be constitutional or not. The people in office don't give. It's what can I do that's going to keep me here? And in the House, go ahead.
Well, Mike, this brings me to another question. Do you think the age of that is coming to an end with essentially just pushing forward an extremely unpopular agenda that's nobody wants? Do you think that there's a seismic shift happening in terms of that now?
Well, right now the politicians just don't care. The politicians are riding a huge wave, and they started this, you know, and you guys who know me know that I'm no Trump fan. The devil would be better than Joe Biden, I believe, but I'm no Trump fan. But if you look at a PSYOP, as a PSYOP is constructed, and you think that from